Blog Talk Radio.
Commentary, but we're going to share today some of the poetry, a bit of the poetry of quite an interesting fellow, an Irish poet, C.S. Lewis. Perhaps you've heard. It's not to be intemperate. I want to. I've been noticing things that I tend to do. I noticed that I should do better, in my opinion, when they have that have a schooling in Masonic values and principles. No, that doesn't necessarily mean sitting at the knee of the masters or an Ashmolean library. There's different ways that people absorb the information that they about the details that helps them form ideas, not only about Freemasonry, but their connection with it. And one of the subtext for Masonic effects has been that, to make information of this nature, this level, comfortable to access. Not that it fits into every single lodge meeting. I think that would be tedious, and after a while I would be dreading it. But in its time and in its place, it works. Much to the chagrin of populists, I think, some conversations, some information and exchange happen more effectively in a small group. Not to say that a large audience isn't able to absorb information, but to digest these ideas, to explore the nuance, the intimacy of small group, 3, 4, 5 of our fellows together, I tend to think is a reflection of the way Masonry got off the ground so very many centuries ago, when you and I and our mates were at the table thinking about putting together ideas, not necessarily frivolous men, not necessarily solemn. We weren't. There's nothing that dictates that knowledge has to be conveyed in a solemn manner, but it is a serious event. Not all men, as we know, are inclined that way. That's not a fault. That's a description. That's their nature. But for the rest, for some of us, the sonic effect brings it to you. Today, our commentary, I think, is, stating the obvious. I hope we go a little bit beyond that. But a lot of what we do is stating the obvious. If you're an observant person, I think you'll understand what we're getting at here. The music, we're going to start it off today with a bit by Clifford Brown. And if you haven't enjoyed Clifford Brown up to now, you're in for a treat. This is some of that audaciousness that is just so remarkable. Check this out. It's called Easy Living.
Thank you.
bad. Not a bad. So top up whatever you're sipping on. Sit back. Whether you put on the headphones or you're sharing this with some friends, let me know what you think. Stating the obvious, being an emerging culture, yes, I am talking about Canada, where I am now. Being an emerging culture in a young, aspiring nation spread over 5 time zones, where a good quality of life, governing an educated population capable of critical thinking, that was and is fertile ground for masonry in Upper Canada, where today I find myself musing on stale preoccupations over the condition. Pressed so closely into the trees, we haven't seen the forest for over 100 years, so it surprises some that communities are evolving. People are moving around. Lodges are fading as naturally as the change of seasons. Everything must die, except good ideas. Freemasonry has traveled well across thousands of kilometers of ocean, yet with an immediacy born out of our history. Without the benefit of a gentry or a mercantile elite, Freemasonry has grown from the middle, leaning toward all the benefits and pitfalls of elected accountabilities. Were we pious enough? Were we without complaint? Were expectations in line? Did we meet expectations? Fascinated though we might be by the history, this mysterious alchemy of applied arts and sciences, we have out of necessity had to create much of the context ourselves. Fortunately, accelerated migration and a strong work ethic handed us unchallenged source of new members. Perhaps it is unfair to compare the enthusiasm of the South Sea bubble, except that it suits us. The 1720s were a different time. Right, you are. Unlike those Scots, we didn't aspire to establish a new world trading bloc promising huge returns for those adventurous enough to invest. But armed with hindsight, we can find a parallel. Disappointment when reality overtook enthusiasm. In fairness, we made masonry accessible across and an enormous landmass without precedent. And it worked initially and for a long time. When the forces that gave rise to unrestrained growth adapted, there for everyone to see. Unfortunately, our unchecked aspirations did not. Until now. So, it's inevitable. It's inevitable. Stating the obvious, you take a look at it. The obvious is always, I think, when we can consider what it is we want and what it is we're seeing, and compare the two. I mean, some in boyish fashion only want to ball their little fists and talk about what it is they want. I want to see the world in this particular way. It becomes absurd, of course, when we're talking about it. We're looking at the works of ideologues or it's just ridiculous people. People that are divisive. People that are expressing xenophobia, anxieties and fears, fear of the unknown, or thoughtlessness. Fear, not because of something that they've developed in their own mind, but because they've been taught that. Yeah, people are able to influence others. So it wasn't always the military that picked up on this idea, but that was where this advertising was cultivated. The First World War, it's like this little light bulb went on for all these corporations saying, my goodness, if jingoism works and we can apply that, ratchet it down and sell our snake oil. And we've been subject to that ever since. One man's propaganda is another man's statement of fact. We are moving ahead in a very natural and organic way. It's hard. You know, let's admit that we don't have these conversations in lodges enough, acknowledging that all around us is not necessarily peril. Yes, we need to right to this ship. Yes, I can understand that. In other words, are we satisfied with this? Well, no. You know, I'm part of that group of you that feels we can always do better. But rather than just throwing that out there with no real gravitas, we deserve, and the next generations deserve that confident, aspiring direction. Keep our eye on the ball here, gentlemen. Keep our eye on the ball. Let's not lose track. Are there seasons to the weather? Well, yeah. They may be more or less pronounced where you happen to be, but are there seasons to the weather? Yeah. Do we affect our climate? Well, yeah. Are we part of the natural scale of things? Yeah. Are we more powerful than nature? I laugh already. Sometimes we stumble and get into our own way. We overthink things. And it's regrettable. If we want to reflect and understand our set point, our balance point, what is at the core of us. It's easy to do it when we're put under pressure. We want to put a test to a man's values. Watch him under pressure. Anybody can la-di-da and fluff around when it really isn't significant, when there aren't significant consequences, or he thinks there's not. But when he's put to the test, everything about masonry draws us toward that. The test is coming or has come. That are you true to the values or not? Right? Seems to be a yes or no. I wish the world was just so clean, black and white. Are we pious or are we not? Well, the pious would say it's a black and white world. I'm not so sure. I fall into that category. Sometimes it's very hard, very difficult to understand the ethical thing to do or to say. When that happens, I find myself a bit of a standstill. And I've begun to realize that's not necessarily a bad thing. When you don't know what to do, do nothing. Oh, we pointed fingers at a lot of our faceless senior members claiming that it's a matter of not being able to embrace change. Nothing could be further from the truth, I think. That's just a way of capturing the anxieties that are around. It must be that we don't like change. And that must be consistent because we're a part of an historical body. Well, if you're part of an historical body, of course not. You ask yourself, are you part of something that is simply a reenactment of a bygone day? We, is masonry all about living in the past? Well, many of us would completely disagree with that. You and I didn't kneel to take the obligation of somebody from the past. We took it for ourselves. The declarations we made are from us in the moment. Oh, everything we do and all our plans are there to help us today and with a view of tomorrow. So the people that are throwing their hands in the air and thinking that they don't like history are, it's kind of odd, isn't it? They're actually living history. And isn't that a son of a gun? Here's little Bobby Hutcherson. This is from material he did in 2007. Thank you. Another jazz great. Bobby Hutcherson died all too soon. Left us something magic. Check it out, the Bobby Hutcherson Quartet. Brilliant stuff. Good stuff. Good stuff. Sometimes graced by people of some supreme talent, it seems. How do they find that unique blend of oils or the concept itself? How could you look beyond what's really supposed to be there, according to the boys that wear braces and belts? How do they look beyond? How does Impressionism, how did it come about? Did those people see? And they shared it. You know, if you look back, you don't see the detail. You see the impression of the detail. It's proximity, isn't it? And then to be taken to another level by that. Picasso, he was such a beautiful, if you've ever seen some of his drawing, his portraiture, it's remarkable, just remarkable how skilled he was. But of course, we went on and saw him launch the Cubist movement. Not entirely alone, I guess you'd say, in a vacuum, but part of a unique process. We go along, and then there is this sidebar, this anomaly. And it fascinates us. In masonry, we've been fascinated for a long time. These things that we take for granted, the architecture around, in particular, let's look at the architecture of 11th, 12th century, the cathedrals, and know that the engineering that was going on was revolutionary, revolutionary. And so when it worked, we would, the masses would stand back in awe, those vaulted ceilings. How does it work? How did those forces keep that shape above us so high to create this captured space that it makes a man feel so small and insignificant? It's as if he's walking past the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. It's cathedrals were symbols of the greatness of nature. C.S. Lewis, Clive Staples Lewis. He was born in Belfast, Ireland, on the 29th of November in 1898. And his father was a solicitor who had moved from Wales, as people tended to do, as they do today, move for opportunity. He married a woman, Flora, that was the daughter of a Church of Ireland priest, Anglicanish. But when Lewis was 4 years old, his dog, Jaxie, was killed by a car. And he announced that his name was now Jaxie. The dead would live on. I'm named like that. It's an old world, isn't it? And many of us, our names are symbolic of other people in other times. An effort at continuity and family and bloodlines. For at first, 4 years old, imagine he wouldn't answer to any other name. But he later accepted Jack, the name his friends and family called him for the rest of his life. But he became fascinated with anthropomorphic animals. You know, animals that are given human qualities. Little boy fell in love with Beatrix Potter's stories. And he created a whole world, especially with his brother,
Morney, the world of Buxton, and it was inhabited and run by animals. Fascinating, interesting guy. That's not all why we're, he was friends with somebody, that a writer that I admired a great deal. I came on the tail end of the college cult following of J.R.R. Tolkien, Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit. Well, that really in the 60s, 50s and 60s, that became sort of the pass around, the hand around, must read kind of thing amongst the dilettantes of the time. And I was a student in the early 70s, and it came to me that way. And I was just enthralled, and particularly because you're studying a little more about the writer and his background and the knowledge base that was needed in order to put together these beautiful imaginary landscapes was just, defining and satisfying at the same time. Lewis was friends with J.R.R. Tolkien, and it was Tolkien that encouraged Lewis as a man to come back to the church and return to Anglicanism. And he was 32. Now, both of them, they were both served on the English faculty at Oxford University and were active in this Oxford literary group known as the Inklings. Inklings, that's the name of my dinghy. Who knew? But he died shortly before, just a couple of days before his 65th birthday. So honored and loved was C.S. Lewis that if you're ever at Westminster Abbey, you'll know that there's a poet's corner and you'll see the memorial to C.S. Clive Jack Lewis. Here, On Being Human, a poem by C.S. Lewis. Angelic minds, they say, by simple intelligence, behold the forms of nature. They discern unerringly the archetypes, all the varieties which mortals lack or indirectly learn, transparent in primordial truth, unvarying, pure earthness and right stonehood from their clear high eminence are seen. Unveiled, the seminal huge principles appear, the treeness of the tree they know, the meaning of arboreal life, how from earth's salty lap the solar beam uplifts it, all the holiness enacted by leaves fall and rising sap, but never an angel knows the knife-edge severance of sun from shadow where the trees begin, the blessed cool at every pore caressing us. An angel has no skin. They see the form of air, but mortals breathing it drink the whole summer down into the breast. The lavish pinks, the field, new mown, the ravishing sea smells, the wood fire smoke that whispers rest, the tremor on the rippled pool of memory that from each smell in widening circles goes, the pleasure and the pang, can angels measure it? No, angel, an angel has no nose. The nourishing of life and how it flourishes by on death and why they utterly know, but not the whole hill-born, earthy spring, the dark cold bilberries, the ripe peach from the southern wall, still hot, full-bellied tankards, foamy-topped, the delicate half-lyric lamb, a new loaf's billowy curves, nor porridge, nor the tingling taste of oranges. An angel has no nerves. Far richer they, I know, the senses' witchery guards us like air, and from heavens too big to see, imminent death to man that barbed some limity and the dazzling edge of beauty unsheathed would be. Yet here with this tiny, charmed interior, this parlor of the brain, their maker shares with living men some secrets in a privacy, forever ours, not theirs.
Oh, it's hot. I'm feeling mighty lonesome. I haven't slept a wink. I walk the floor and watch the door, and in between I drink black coffee with a little brandy in it. Love's a hand-me-down broom.
Sometimes when I listen to Sarah Vaughan, and I became a fan of hers back when I was still a student listening, my friend Jerry from Midtown Manhattan, taking the same kind of courses in theory. And of course, he led me to New York. Manhattan led me into jazz. She was magnificent. So I learned a lot. Sarah Vaughan, I always felt from the start, it was just an odd feeling. And I realized after a while that the feeling was me experiencing this intimacy. And ever after, I felt that when I hear her sing, she's only singing to me. There's nobody else in the world. To those of you who have bothered to think about it or put it together, you'll have begun to realize that Masonic effects uses symbolism. We use to create something, to create a mood, nothing malevolent, to create a feeling. Yeah, Freemasonry. Masonry is content. It is process, but it's something more. And that's definable. It's a feeling. That feeling is the building block of the bond that we feel, that we refer to as a fraternity, as a brotherhood. But at this level, that the notion of brotherhood transcends gender. It's a feeling, a connection between human beings. Oh, salacious little boys that will always feel that they can't separate out the sexuality from the humanness of gender. Just like they can't necessarily separate out the fact that everything dies. Except good ideas, and they die if good men don't do anything with them. But they come around again. It's a bit like science. Freemasonry, on the other hand, is a bit more, I think, like art. It is what it is in the moment. The artist has that talent at that moment. Think of all the great artists, the great painters, the sculptors. Think of Bellini's work. Now, that was done then, so we should see that kind of mentality. We should see the apprentice pillar being made all over the place. Not copied, but made. And we don't. Art is of the moment, of the time. If an artist isn't born and doesn't produce his work, then humanity will not experience that ever. But science, the rules of science compel us to believe that if we don't just make the discovery today, if we don't make the linkage, we don't find the language of the different forms of science today, eventually, everything being consistent, somebody in the future will make those discoveries. So when I weigh them out in one hand, I look at science a little different than I do at art. Art, I embrace. As I got older, I can be more honest about that. When I see a group of men shuffling their feet and feeling awkward because some artist has expressed a penetrating idea, I don't necessarily follow. And I find that there are others who feel the same way, react the same way. Art and the beauty of it, it's like talking about agape. It's like talking about the love between the brothers, the love that we feel. Oh, the more shuffling of feet, and if we get too dramatic about it, the room will empty. Or there will be a group in, that would be sitting there in the middle of the theater, and as the clamor fades away, we'll ask, and where are you going with this? And so what? And that's the masonry. Masonry unpacks these ideas and searches for meaning. And if they have no meaning to you or me, then they have no meaning to you or me, but they may have profound understanding to others. Are we a shelter for human shortcoming? Nah, not very much. Oh, people with shortcomings can disguise themselves for a while, but eventually they know. They find themselves out. Interesting thing about that self-regulation that happens within masonry. Again, it seems to defy the odds. The dice keeps rolling up in our favor. In an imperfect world. So you find that mood when you visit Masonic effects, not my mood, the mood that you're capable of pulling together. The beauty of the philosophies and principles. No, it's not necessary that the only ones that you know, the only one that permeates is the one that you find in the darkness of the night when you're alone reading. We learn from many different ways, some planned and some unplanned. Sometimes, and I find these are some of the best treats, is when I listen to somebody pointing out something, and it's beautiful listening to it, and then all of a sudden, it's like, I knew that. Well, yeah. We knew that but we didn't know it until it was pointed out, but we knew it. We were studying a while, and it was teetering on the import of the effect of scripture. And personally, I cringe when I can't get over it. When I think about the delicacy with which our ancient brethren approached the notion of religion. They were very careful to ensure that every faith was welcomed and acknowledged as not to exclude, but to include. They were careful to do that. And when I hear references over and over, I have to set my thinking aside that I live in a secular environment as part of a group that do not necessarily endorse secularism. We have an odd secularism in masonry. It's secularism, but it's faith-based. It's belief in something of a greater power. Maybe somebody comes along and says, that greater power is nature, and all around me is the expression of God. Well, okay, there's physicists that say that. Not that listening to a physicist makes anybody any smarter, or listening to a poet makes anybody any more artistic, but it sure as hell helps. We've been talking about when the King James Version was pulled together. It was a derivative. Bibles tend to be that way. Oh, my goodness. They tend to be derivative. But there were works, there were elements put in it that were a pledge, a link to antiquity. Because, as we know, a claim of antiquity is a claim of an expression of legitimacy. My ancestors were here longer ago than yours, therefore I have a more legitimate sense of citizenship. And we know kings would do that, ancient kings and current kings, and governments do it, and Anderson did it in our work. So, yes, you believe what you find evidence to support, but he sort of conjured up a bit of a magical thinking when he was putting together a history. But he was a good soldier. He was a good mason. He was asked to do it, and he did it. He created the history, literally. So when we were thinking here about a fourfold claim, Yes, we'll dive into this a little bit, but once we're through it, we won't do it again for a long, long time, unless you do it on your own. It's about the fourfold claim of our regard, about the Bible, of all things. Of all things. Yes, and I'm one of those people that subscribe to the notion that there is no such thing as a Masonic Bible. Well, we haven't seen Masonry produce a Bible, but there's Bibles that are used by Masons, just like there are other forms of holy books that are used, that Scripture used in Masonic lodges. We don't have Masonic variations in any of them. No. No, no. But there are fourfold. If you think about this, it's a claim of the Bible. It's antiquity. I think apply this to Masonry. It's antiquity, it's history, it's adaptability, and it's inspiration. Fourfold claim. Apply those same rules, those same ideas to Freemasonry. It appeals to, because of its antiquity, its history, its adaptability, and its inspiration. Good, huh? That's good. Now, I don't care if you agree with everything that we say, but that part is really good. It's antiquity. This by itself would not make a strong claim. Many institutions attain an old age because it has not been worth anyone's while to pull them down. Oh, are we getting into this with Masonry? Not been worth anyone's while to pull it down? Hells no, not on my watch. But still, whatever value antiquity may give, our Bible has it. Not a word in it is less than 1,800 years old. It is the work of writers and translators who have written hundreds of years apart, but all with the same intention, God's revelation of himself to men. There is no other book in the world that even pretends to give a sober, connected account of prehistoric events. And nothing in it is grander than its opening sentence. It does not presume to suggest that people are to derive their knowledge of God from its record on that page. It assumes God's existence and begins. In the beginning, God created. Just get into that. What in the world does that mean? But what has been its history? There are other ancient and dignified works in existence, the works of classic writers, full of noble thoughts, which, however grand they are, have survived only by reason of the anxious care of scholars of all ages. And even with that, they are of common reach. The languages in which they are written are dead. I don't believe, I think I've heard of one Aramaic scholar. That was the language that Jesus spoke. The languages in which they were written are dead, and they are only to be found dust covered in the top shelves of libraries, known to none but the student whose business is to read them. And but little read outside the university classroom. Oh, isn't that the truth? But our Bible, what an eventful history it has had. Yet it has survived unchanged. It has not made the slightest concession either to persecution or intolerance, but little to scholarship. But it stands like some rock, immovable, around which the billows have raged for centuries from every quarter of the compass, to prince and peasant, to gentle and simple, to wise and ignorant alike. The Bible has handed down through the centuries the unchanged message of God's downfall and its consequences. This revelation's relations with God and his only hope of salvation. So the next couple of programs, we'll get into the next, the other aspects, the claim of our regard. This is about the antiquity. Next, we'll get into its history, the adaptability, and its inspiration. Ancient and dignified works in existence. Brilliant. Brilliant. That's good. Fourfold claim. I hope you've, I see that we're drawing to a close. We have to part again. I know you get on with your whatever you have to get on with. It's been a pleasure leaning in and putting our heads together. Hope we've stimulated some conversation and some ideas. And if not, at the very least, you like the poetry of C.S. Lewis, an introduction to you, or some interesting jazz. Anyway, I hope I get to see you again soon. It would be a pleasure to sit and lodge with you wherever you happen to be and around the world. Remember, we conduct ourselves as Freemasons in with a sense of dignity. Don't let that slide. Whether you're old or young, doesn't give your tongue any more legitimacy. Think about the effect of what you're saying before you say it on those that are around hearing you. It matters. Here, a little Stan Getz. God, I love Stan Getz, don't you? Thanks for the memory. It's from 1952. Check it out. And goodbye, and thank you for tuning in. Thank you, Japan. Thank you, Belgium. Thank you, Netherlands. Thank you, UK. And America. Yeah. And of course, Canada. See you again in a couple of weeks. I'm off to North Bay and for an annual special communication, and we'll crank it up in a couple of weeks. Bye.
Mm-hmm.